Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, we present the second half of our interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and historian John Meacham. His latest book, American Struggle, Democracy, Dissent, and the Pursuit of a More Perfect Union, was published by Random House in February of this year. And in this episode, Meacham talks with fellow biographer and bio member Jack Farrell about his impressive literary output.
So you start out with Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson. You're dipping now into maybe the 1A tier by doing Eisenhower. A president asks you to write his biography and helps you with it.
Yep.
And yet I would love you to tell our listeners the Dan Rather story.
So 10 years ago, maybe. Dan has done a book about the country. And I get a call from Parnassus, our great Nashville bookstore, saying, would you come do an event with Rather? And I said, sure, of course. So we're at the War Memorial Auditorium in Nashville. And it's a hometown crowd. So it's in, I live here. And we're getting ready to go out on stage. And Rather's a pretty tall guy, and I'm not. And he's sort of leaning over me. And he says, I really want to ask you about Hamilton before the night's over. I said, oh, that'd be great. Sure. I don't really know much about Hamilton, but okay. So we go out on stage and we're doing our thing. And about 4 minutes in, he says, well, Ron, as you know, XYZ. And there's kind of a frisson in the crowd because, you know, these are people I know. And I noted it and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then he did it again. And then he said something about Grant and what I knew about Grant. And I thought, oh, my God, he thinks I'm Chernow. And I never let him know.
That's fine. But it's a humbling moment that you probably needed.
Well, so the other, if I may, the other story about that is I was on my way to give my talk about Jackson at the National Book Festival when it was on the Mall. Remember?
Uh-huh. Yeah. In the tents.
Yeah. Laura Bush had set it up. And a woman runs up to me and says, oh, God, it's you. I love your books. Will you wait right here? And I said, yes, ma'am. And I stood there. And she brought back John Grisham's latest novel. So I signed a copy of The Runaway Jury.
There you go.
It is useful and humbling.
Yeah. So for people who were not part of the journalist industry as I was, they may not know that you were one of the bright young rising stars of journalism before you were the old master of biography. But at some point, you left.
You're like cultural Zoloft. This is great.
At some point, you left journalism and chose to take a path into biography. Why biography?
So I was a news magazine guy, which was basically biography by week. As you know, I mean, that was the loose model.
A lot of profiles.
You always have a person on the cover.
Yeah.
You know, I was at Newsweek. Look, I'm incredibly fortunate, as I mentioned before, because the path I took is not really replicatable. Because I started a daily newspaper, the Chattanooga Times. I went to work for Charlie Peters at the Washington Monthly. I went to Newsweek for 15 years, loved it. It was when the Washington Post Company owned it. Was incredibly lucky. You know, I worked with Evan Thomas, and it was just a phenomenal experience. And then we just got clobbered by the internet. And so the business model went away. And the reason I did the first book about Roosevelt and Churchill in part was therapy because, and this sounds crazy now to anyone younger than us, which is now most people, I guess. But early on in weekly journalism, I found the need to be all-knowing and wise every 6 days about the panoply of human experience to be difficult, to render instant judgment. Now, all we do now, culturally, obviously, is
Yes.
render in instant judgment. So this is the late 20th century, early 21st. And I remember having an explicit thought. I wonder if the editors of Newsweek and of Time, when Roosevelt and Churchill were in power, were sitting around saying, Jesus, if only we could have Lloyd George and Wilson again. Right? You know, like that previous generation always being a little better and the current crowd always being not commensurate. And so I went and looked, and they kind of did. So the issue of Newsweek, first issue of Newsweek published after D-Day, was not Liberation Begins. It was Why Didn't They Know More About the Hedgerows? Yeah, it was the road to Berlin, trouble ahead, time will tell, all that. And it was in some ways the origins, or at least an echo of the themes we're talking about. It's like, my God, I mean, these guys are running a global war. And how on earth could anyone get everything right? And so I'm sometimes asked, you mentioned President Bush by implication, senior. I'm sometimes asked, what's it like writing about a living person or a dead person?
Great question.
It is. And here's my answer, which may make people think I'm soft or something, but it's what I believe. If Thomas Jefferson or Lincoln could come back and read these books, I would want them to think it was a fair portrait. So to me, the danger in the living person is that we don't have enough perspective about what they've done and how it's mattered. That's an unavoidable problem. But in terms of, oh, do you pull punches or do you shape things? I think of the subject as I'm writing. And I don't want to render facile judgments. And I think there were parts of the Bush book that Mrs. Bush in particular was unhappy about. So I felt I had been true to the craft. I'd called them as I'd seen them. But I go back to this thing about, I sometimes think of it as the Lincoln Memorial dynamic. Stand outside the Lincoln Memorial, and it's a temple. It's the architecture of the Almighty come to dwell within the temporal, right? The great columns. But then you go in, and what do you see? You see a war-weary, exhausted face. There's a human being within the temple. And so I think, well, my view is, as long as I render the scars on the face, it's okay to be aspirational.
Yeah, I found that it's much easier though to do somebody who's been dead for 100 years than it is to do a book where the kids are around or the widow was around or the friends are going to cut you off
There
halfway through.
are, I call that the awkward lunch problem. Yeah. I've had presidential families chase me down the street with pitchforks. I know, I get it. I get it.
So, but now Doris is sort of retired. David McCullough is gone. You and Ken Burns have sort of inherited the mantle of a national historian, where people come to you to ask you to sort of rub your chin and tell us either it's okay or they're in danger.
Right.
If I had a problem or an issue with the anthology, the new book,
Yeah.
it's that there seems to be, again, the message, which is that we've gone through hard times before, dot, 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 we can do it again, without recognizing the possibility that this could be an even more dangerous time, which would sort of, you might have to take the mantle of national historian off your shoulders and instead be national alarmist. Do you feel from your prominent position the need to be more patriotic?
No, I don't. And I if I may, I disagree. The book closes with a piece saying we're no longer a democracy. And I don't know if you're doing an anthology of American moments, necessarily they're going to be ones we came through because we've come through.
Good point.
So I would push back a little on that. No, I don't feel that I have to be Mr. Rogers. And I don't think it does any good. And I don't know if we're going to make it. I've been very explicit. I've written this. I thought the first 5 years of the Trump world, 15 to 20, I did think. I thought it was a difference of degree, not kind. I thought, okay, that's a little Huey Long, that's a little George Wallace, but I get it. Then came the attack on the election, not just January 6th, but the unfolding plot to steal the election. And I think, but for Mike Pence, I think we might not have made it. Because the plan, as you know, was to create so much chaos by not certifying on the 6th that you would roll into the next week, you begin to hit the inauguration, 12th Amendment would have to come in, the House would vote. Presumably, Trump would have won because it's a unit rule. So, what do you do if you have a constitutionally sanctified remedy for an illegal result? I don't know what you do. And so, I think we came as close in that hour as we have since the 1860s to losing the Republic. And in 2024, I wrote what I just said, argued it a lot, that I think President Trump represents a unique threat. And it's not just him, it is the enablers. It's the 49.9% of the country, still not 50. But, you know, my view is that 35% of the country is always pretty extreme. That's the number that still approved of Joe McCarthy after he fell from power. The greatest danger and the greatest responsibility lies with the 14.9% of what I call Peter Millar Republicans. Right? These are guys on the driving range who have decided for a series of reasons that this is worth the risk. And so I might quibble with you on the national historian thing, but my argument is that the only way the experiment continues is by A, reminding ourselves why we're doing it. And B, and this is the hardest thing of all, be willing to win graciously and lose graciously. And if we don't have that moral capacity, then 250 years was a good run. So I'm not in the, oh, we're so resilient, we'll make it. What I am in is that we don't need 70% to make it. We just need 51, 52% of folks to say, you know what? I'm willing to defer my immediate gratification to continue to have politics as an arena of contention. And there's a reason we didn't want a king then, and we shouldn't want one now.
Let me ask you one more question before we close. And again, this is a story that I've heard you tell about politics, about George Herbert Walker Bush. And if I remember correctly, you were trying to get him to sort of get past the Poppy Bush, Greenwich, Connecticut, sporty George Bush, and get down to the grappling in the weeds with the political opponent. And let me see that side of you. You haven't shown that to me. Tell that story if you know the one I'm talking about.
So I spent a lot of years, 17 years, interviewing him. It was supposed to be posthumous. He wouldn't die. I'd bring it up. He'd say, not going to do it. Dana Carvey once said, the key to doing the old man's voice was Mr. Rogers trying to be John Wayne. So perfect example. So we were in Houston and we'd spent the morning sort of jousting about this. I said, well, why did you go into all this? You know, you could have made a bunch of money. You could have had a great life. You would have been in Larchmont or Greenwich and played more golf. And he said, well, I wanted to serve. Wanted to serve. Serve. Give back. Okay. All right. I said, well, okay, sir. That's great. But you know, you could have opened a soup kitchen, right? You sought ultimate power in a nuclear age. And, you know, let's ask Michael Dukakis about how genial you really could be. And we moved on. About 5 hours later, that was in his office. So we were at the house and we were in the room. It was me, Mrs. Bush, and President Bush. Mrs. Bush and I are talking, or she's talking and I'm listening. That's the way that went. And the president isn't participating. And all of a sudden, he sort of looks up like a marionette kind of being pulled up. And he had this big left hand. He was left-handed. He always spoke with it. And he made a big fist. And without context, he said, "It's be number one. It's be the captain of the team. It's win the game. There's a lot wrong with that, but there's a lot right with that too. Politics isn't a pure undertaking. Not if you want to win, it's not." And then he kind of like a marionette kind of went back down into himself. What fascinated me about it, and what I guess stuck with you about it, is that the question had been ricocheting around, right? And we all know in journalism and biography, you got to have the patience to ask the question 100 times. I call it the frontline problem. So many of these guys have an answer they've given so much, like when frontline comes and asks you this question, you have to get past the frontline answer. And that was an it was a self-aware moment.
Was there any trick you can teach to biographers, young biographers, other
Iron
than
hat.
be
Iron hat.
patient and wait?
That's it. You just got to do it and shut up. And that's the hardest thing, right? Particularly if you're writing about someone who has been a great figure in the world. There's an impulse to, presidents talk about this sometimes. Eisenhower once said he only had two kinds of people who'd come talk to him: people who couldn't speak or couldn't shut up. Right? You see what I mean? There's sort of these one of two reactions. And it's hard, right? And also, if you're writing a biography of the person, this is to the young whippersnappers, you kind of want to tell them what you found, right? It's kind of fun. I remember seeing an underutilized source, and I don't know quite when, if it's still going on. I know it was going on in the Biden administration, but there's a ton of videography in the White House. And I think it basically started under President Reagan. There's a video of Edmund Morris talking to Reagan in the Oval Office.
Edmund
That's
Morris, his biographer.
sort of misbegotten project. And Edmund is sitting there and he's telling Reagan what he's found out about what was going on when he was born in Tampico or wherever it was in Illinois. And it's great, right? And Reagan's sort of enjoying it. But I'm thinking, if you're doing that, that's a half hour. You're not hearing anything from him. And I understand it. This is a sin I commit all the time. But I think the ability to sit with uncomfortable silence is one of the secret weapons.
Well, all right, one last trick question. This is a Stacey Schiff question. Have any of your subjects appeared in your dreams?
It's so funny you should ask that. I had a dream recently about Franklin Roosevelt. And we were on a car, and I don't know where we were going, but when I woke up, I thought, what is going on? That FDR, that I'm dreaming about Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, he's the
So
guy
that,
we need.
and all of us have what recency bias, right? We all see, I think we all see the world through the eyes of the person we have most recently spent the most time with.
Well, with me, it's always the two guys who I actually knew in life. I can't get the other two who I never met, although I love to talk to them. But Teddy and Tip are always, not always, but the other ones who will appear. It's an interesting question. Well, thanks, John. Thank you very much.
See ya.
Take
Thanks.
care.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and historian John Meacham, talking with bio member Jack Farrell in April of this year about his latest book, American Struggle: Democracy, Dissent, and the Pursuit of a More Perfect Union. It was published by Random House in February 2026, and next week we'll present the second half of this fascinating interview. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer, and Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.